British and American intelligence appraisals showed that Josiah Nkunzi, despite all his extreme left-wing rhetoric and the military assistance which he had solicited and received from Communist China and the Soviet bloc countries, was a pragmatist. From the Western viewpoint, he was far and away the least of many much greater evils. His elimination would clear the way for a horde of truly vicious Marxist monsters to take over and lead the nation to be Zimbabwe into the clutches of the big red bear. A secondary consideration was that a successful Rhodesian assassination coup on Nkunzi would bolster the slowly flagging fighting resolve of the Rhodesian UDI government, and would render Ian Smith and his gang of right-wing cabinet ministers even less amenable to reason than he had been to date. No, it was absolutely essential that Josiah Nkunzi's life be protected at all costs, and Douglas Hunt Jeffries tickled the sleeping woman gently. "Wake up, pussycat," he said. "It's time to talk." She sat up and stretched, and then groaned softly and touched herself cautiously. "Ah," she murmured huskily. "I ache all over, inside and out, and boy, it feels good." "Light each of us a cigarette," he ordered, and she fitted one into his ivory holder with practiced dexterity, lit it, and placed it between his lips. "When do you expect the next courier from Lusaka?" He blew a spinning smoke ring that broke on her bosom like mist on a hilltop. "Overdue," she said. "I told you about the Amlima." "Oh, yes," Douglas nodded. "The spirit medium. The arrangements to move her are all in hand, and Lusaka is sending a high party official, probably a commissar, to take charge of the transfer. He'll arrive at any time." "Seems a lot of trouble to go to for a senile old witch doctor." "She is the spiritual leader of the Matabele people," Layla told him fiercely. "Her presence with the guerrilla army would be of incalculable value to their morale." "Yes, I understand. You explained the superstitions to me." Douglas stroked her cheek soothingly, and she subsided gradually. "So they're sending a commissar. Well, that's good. Though it always puzzles me how they move back and forth across the border, in and out of the towns, and from one end of the country to the other, with so little trouble." "To the average white man, one black face looks the same as every other," Layla explained. "There's no system of passes or passports. Every village is a base, nearly every black person an ally. As long as they do not carry arms or explosives, they can use the buses and railways and pass through the roadblocks with impunity." "Yes, all right," Douglas agreed. "Just as long as what I have for you gets back to Lusaka as soon as possible." "Now, by next week at the latest," Layla promised. "The Ballantine scouts are setting up a full-scale operation to cull Nkunzi and his staff at the safe house in Lusaka." "Oh, my God, no," Layla gasped with shock. "Yes, I'm afraid so, unless we can warn him. Now, here are the details. Memorize them, please." The rackety old bus came down the winding road through the hills, leaving behind it a long, greasy black smear of diesel fumes, which drifted sluggishly aside on the small breeze. The roof racks were piled with bundles tied with rope and pieces of string, with cardboard boxes and cheap suitcases, with squawking chickens in cages of plaited bark and bent green twigs, and with other less readily identifiable packages. The driver slammed on his brakes when he saw the roadblock ahead, and the chattering and laughter of the passengers died into an uneasy silence. As soon as the bus stopped, the black passengers poured out of the forward entrance, and under the direction of the waiting armed police, separated into groups according to their sex, men to one side, women and their children to the other. In the meantime, two black constables climbed aboard to search the empty bus for fugitives hiding under the seats or for hidden weapons. Comrade Tungata Zabiwa was amongst the huddle of male passengers. He was dressed in a floppy hat, a ragged shirt and short khaki trousers. On his feet were filthy tennis shoes, and his big toes protruded through the stained canvas uppers. He seemed typical of the unskilled itinerant labourers who made up the great bulk of the country's labour force. He was safe, just as long as the police check was cursory, but he had every reason to believe that this one would not be. After crossing the Zambezi drifts in darkness and negotiating the cordon sanitaire, he had made his way south through the abandoned strip and reached the main road near the collieries at Wankey. He was travelling alone and carrying forged employment papers to show that he had been discharged 2 days previously from employment as a labourer at the collieries. It should have been enough to take him throughout any ordinary roadblock. However, 2 hours after he had boarded the crowded bus, and when they were approaching the outskirts of Bulawayo, he realised suddenly that there was another Zipra courier amongst the passenger. She was a Matabele woman in her late 20s, who had been in the training camp with him in Zambia. She was also dressed like a peasant girl, and had an infant strapped upon her back in the traditional fashion. Tungata studied her surreptitiously as the bus roared southwards, hoping that she might not be carrying incriminating material. If she was, and if she was picked up at the roadblock, then every other passenger in the bus would be subjected to full security scrutiny, which included fingerprints, and as a former Rhodesian government employee, Tungata's fingerprints were on the files. The woman, although his ally and comrade, was a deadly danger to him now. She was a totally unimportant pawn, a mere courier, and she was expendable. But what was she carrying at the moment? He watched her surreptitiously, looked for any indication of her status, and then suddenly his attention focused on the infant strapped to the girl's back. With a swoop of dread in the pit of his stomach, Tungata realized the worst. The woman was active. If they took her, they would almost certainly take Tungata also. Now he lined up with the other male passengers for the body search by the black police members. On the far side of the bus, the women passengers were forming a separate line. Women police would search them to the skin. The girl courier was in fifth place in the line. She was joggling the sleeping infant on her back, and its tiny head waggled from side to side. Tungata could wait no longer. Abruptly, he pushed his way to the front of the queue and spoke urgently but quietly to the black sergeant in charge of the search. Then Tungata pointed deliberately at the girl in the woman's line. The girl saw the accuser's finger pointing at her. She looked about her and then broke from the line and started to run. "Stop her!" the sergeant bellowed, and the running girl loosed the strap of cloth that held the infant to her back and let the tiny black body fall to the earth. Freed of her burden, she raced for the line of thick thornbrush along the verge of the road. However, the roadblock had been laid to prevent just such an escape, and two police constables rose from concealment at the edge of the bush. The girl doubled back, but they had her trapped, and a heavy blow with a gun butt knocked her sprawling in the grass. They dragged her back, struggling and kicking, spitting and snarling like a cat, and as she passed Tungata, she shrieked at him, "Traitor! We will eat you, jackal! You will die!" Tungata stared at her with bovine indifference. One of the constables picked up the naked infant from where the girl had abandoned it, and he exclaimed immediately, "It is cold!" He turned the body gingerly, and the tiny limbs sprawled lifelessly. "It is dead!" The constable's voice was shocked. And then he started again. "Look! Look at this!" The child's body had been gutted like that of a fish. The cut ran upwards from its groin, across its stomach, through the sternum of the chest to the base of the little throat, and the wound had been closed with sacking twine and crude cobbled stitches. The white police captain, with a sickly expression on his face, snipped the stitches and the body cavity bulged open. It was packed with ropes of brown plastic explosive. "All right," the captain stood up. "Hold them all. We'll run a full check on every one of the bastards." Then the captain came to Tungata. "Well done, friend," he clapped Tungata's shoulder. "You can claim your reward from the main police station, $5,000. "That's good, eh? You just give them this," he scribbled on his notebook and tore off the sheet. "That's my name and rank. I will witness your claim. One of our Land Rovers will be going into Bulawayo in a few minutes. I'll see you get a lift into town." Tungata submitted docilely to the customary search by the guards at the gates to Kami Mission Hospital. He was still dressed in his labourer's rags and carrying the forged discharge from the Wankey collieries. One of the guards glanced at the work papers. "What is wrong with you?" "I have a snake in my stomach." Tungata clasped his hands over the offending organ. A snake in the stomach could mean anything from colic to duodenal ulcers. The guard laughed. The doctors will cut out your mamba for you. Go to the outpatients department. He pointed out the side entrance, and Tungata went up the driveway with an ungainly, sloppy gait. The Matabele sister at the outpatient desk recognized him with a flicker of surprise. Then her expression went deadpan, and she made out a card for him and waved him to one of the crowded benches. A minute or two later, the black sister rose from the desk and crossed to the door marked Duty Doctor. She went in and closed the door behind her. When she came out again, she pointed at Tungata. You next, she said. Tungata shambled across the hall and went in through the same door. Layla St. John came joyfully to meet him as soon as he closed the door behind him. Comrade Commissar, she whispered and embraced him. I was so worried. She kissed him on each cheek, and as she stepped back, Tungata had changed character from dull-witted peasant to deadly warrior, tall and dangerously cold-faced. You have clothes for me? Behind the movable screen, Tungata changed swiftly and stepped out again, buttoning the white laboratory coat. On his lapel, he wore a plastic dog tag that identified him as Dr. G.J. Kumalu, which placed him immediately above idle suspicion. I would like to know what arrangements you have made, he said, and seated himself facing Layla St. John across her desk. I have had the Amlimo in our geriatric ward since she was brought in by her followers from the Metopus Reservation about 6 months ago. What is her physical condition? She's a very old lady. Ancient is perhaps the better word. I see no reason to doubt her claim that she is 120 years old. She was already a young woman when Cecil Rhodes's freebooters rode into Bulawayo and hunted King Lobengula to his death. Her condition, please. She was suffering from malnutrition, but I have had her on a nutritional drip and she is much stronger, though she cannot walk. Nor is she in control of her bowels and bladder. She is an albino, and she suffers from a type of skin allergy, but I have been able to prescribe an antihistamine ointment which has given her a great deal of relief. Her hearing and eyesight are failing, but her heart and other vital organs are remarkably strong for her age. Moreover, her brain is sharp and clear. She appears to be totally lucid. So she can travel? Tungata insisted. She is eager to do so. It is her own prophecy that she must cross the great waters before the spears of the nation prevail. Tungata made an impatient gesture, and Layla St. John interpreted it. You do not set any store by the Amlima and her predictions, do you, comrade? Do you, Doctor? He asked. There are areas which our sciences have not yet penetrated. She is an extraordinary woman. I don't say I believe everything about her, but I am aware of a force within her. It is our estimate that she will be extremely valuable as a propaganda weapon. The great majority of our people are still uneducated and superstitious. You still have not answered my question, Doctor. Can she travel? I think she can. I have prepared medications for her to take on the journey. I have also made out medical certificates, which should be sufficient to see her safely through any security checks as far as the border with Zambia. I will provide one of my best medical orderlies, a black male nurse, to travel with her. I would go myself, but it would attract too much attention. Tungata was silent for a long time, his hard, handsome features wrapped in thought. He had such a presence of command and authority that Layla found herself waiting almost timidly for his next words, eager to respond whether they were a command or a question. However, when he spoke, it was to muse softly, "The woman is as valuable dead as alive, and dead she would be easier to handle. I presume you could preserve her body in formaldehyde or something of that nature?" Despite herself, Layla was shocked, and yet strangely awed by the ruthlessness excited by the man's deadly resolve. "I pray that won't be necessary," she whispered, staring at him. She had never met a man like this. "I will see her first, then I will decide," Tungata said quietly. "I wish to do so immediately."